actually take the music that we're listening to. It would bring us back to, the days pre-television, pre-radio for that matter, where, musicians, some of them with little, musical tuition, but they inherited intuition. They were good. They were great fiddlers. You could take that and bring it, actually, across the Atlantic, where huge waves of immigrants were forced to leave Ireland because Ireland, it was, post-famine, Ireland trying to get itself off the ground, many would say that, those growing up in Ireland at the turn of the century, were being grown for export. And as such, that's why you had pockets of Irish, particularly in areas like New York and Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, and that's only to name a few. Tight, yes. What a tight click they were. They loved, many of them didn't have many memories of Ireland. They were, they were turfed out. Because not only was there not sufficient employment in Ireland for them, but they were expected, indeed, to emigrate, do much better for themselves, and to send money and clothing and everything else home to the next and to the remaining ever-growing clutch of siblings. Such was the case, for a lot of people who came from Ireland, many of them, of course, from the west of Ireland. And one of the great holidays, again, that was celebrated with a particular twist of Thanksgiving was, of course, the Irish American household of Thanksgiving. I mentioned Mike Scanlon with his book, and we'll talk to him maybe after the news. But in the meantime, Mike Scanlon, I mentioned that he was a writer, and his writings have shown up in Irish American Magazine, Irish Central, New York Times, you name it. And of course, back in Sligo and Leitrim, Donegal. Anyway, Mike has, and this is brand new. If you think that you heard this before, he's about to tell us about what it was like at Thanksgiving.
A Bronx Irish Thanksgiving in days gone by. It is just after World War II. Boundless optimism sweeps across America, which is now the acknowledged undisputed leader of the free world. Our family attends the 9 o'clock Mass at Sacred Heart Church in the Highbridge neighborhood of the Bronx. It is Thanksgiving morning. When we get home after Mass, my mother turns to my brother and to me and says, "I'm telling you, when your father sailed to New York from County Sligo in 1928 at age 22, and I landed here from Leitrim a year before him at age 16 all by myself. We had no idea about pilgrims or Indians, turkeys or chestnuts. Mom then bends down, smudging charcoal on my face and on my older brother Johnny's cheeks. "Here," she says, "this will make you look like little ragamuffins. Put on these old patch pants and Daddy's old fedora. Push up the rim there and bend it sideways like a vagabond. That's it." She then stands back, surveying us, making sure we look like street urchins. "Off you go now, and be back before the company arrives this afternoon." We join our fellow little kid ragamuffins, knocking on doors, ringing bells of apartments in our Bronx neighborhood, as we hold out our little purses and we chant, "Anything for Thanksgiving? Anything for Thanksgiving?" We take in the warm, delicious smells of turkeys cooking and cakes and pies baking, wafting from each apartment. People drop a few pennies in our bags, an occasional nickel or a candy treat, and some even hand over empty bottles for us to collect the 2-cent deposit. In the end, we compare our bounty with our fellow little beggars, and we celebrate with a mini feast of our own at Julius Negoff's candy store, buying chocolate turkeys and candy corn. This begging, as ragamuffins on Thanksgiving Day, became a forgotten tradition by the mid-1950s and was replaced by trick-or-treating on Halloween. By that time, our Thanksgiving mornings were no longer taken up being ragamuffins, but we played touch football on the streets, followed by watching the annual football game between the Green Bay Packers and the Detroit Lions on our black and white 13-inch Emerson TV. And then, by mid-afternoon of Thanksgiving Day, our Irish aunts and uncles and cousins arrive for the big dinner. They come clomping up the stairs to our fifth-floor apartment, Cushman cakes and pies in hand. My mother's brother John and his family arrive, with Mom's sister Margaret and her family, and my father's sister Amelia with her family. And just off the boat from County Sligo, my father's 20-year-old niece Dolores McLaughlin, who has come to live with our family in New York City. Everyone is greeted heartily, the men in shirts and ties, the women in their Sunday best, and all the cousins together again. After drinks, served by my Uncle John, who is the bartender at the local Leo Sullivan Saloon, we all settle down for the big meal. At table, we look a bit like the family in Norman Rockwell's painting of A Bountiful Thanksgiving, though I knew nothing of that famous picture in those days. The picture we had hanging in our wall was Millet's painting of the Angelus, a man and a woman bowed in noontime Thanksgiving prayer in the middle of a potato field. There were few activities my mother enjoyed more than that of the hostess of a dinner party for friends and family. She joyed in bringing people together, serving them their favorite cocktail, providing plentiful food and stimulating conversations between people. And then, once seated at a table, heavy with turkey, stuffed with mushrooms, whipped sweet potatoes with marshmallows, green beans with almonds, mashed turnips and juicy cranberries, one of the guests would invariably pipe up, "Ah, maybe, would you ever sit down and join us and stop your running around taking care of everyone else?" And Mom would reply as she serves up yet another dish of vegetables, "Ah, sure, I like it this way, that you all just sit back and enjoy yourselves, and I'll take care of myself. Don't you worry. Here, Bernard, let me refill your glass while I'm at it. And I have creamed onions coming up, so leave some room. And of course, no Irish get-together was complete without the talk of politics. My father and my Uncle Frank both worked on the railroad, which was how the Irish referred to the IRT subway system. Both men adored their firebrand Irish Union leader, Mike Quill. My father says, "Did you hear the one about Mike, the latest?" City Hall said to Quill, "Will you calm down, Mike?" And Quill, in his thick, hairy accent, replied, "The Bible says the meek shall inherit the earth, but I say to ye, the meek shall inherit nothing." Throwing their heads back in laughter, Uncle Frank and Pop lift their glasses. Go get 'em, Mike. I particularly recall the time in the early 1950s when we received news that a 20-year-old Irish greenhorn, a very good friend of the family, had been killed in action in Korea. My father brought the table to silence as he railed against that war. He said, "Well, here's this fine, young, educated lad from County Cork, only in New York a few months before he is drafted into the United States Army. And then, a few months later, he's dead. We never should have gotten into that lousy Korean War." My father looks to my uncles for support. And here's my Uncle Frank, himself a World War II veteran, drafted into the United States Army soon after he arrived from County Cavan in the late 1930s. And there sits my Uncle Bernard McAvoy, drafted in his mid-30s to serve in the United States Navy during World War II. Both men served proudly and say nothing in response to my father except to shake their heads at the tragedy of this young Irish boy's death. "Ah, isn't it the way with these holidays?" my Aunt Vera, a Roscommon woman, pipes up. "Always some tragedy or other taking place. Ah, but enough with all this sadness. Let's have some music." And with that, my father picks up his fiddle and plays a few tunes, always starting with the Stack of Barley, the original Irish melody that gave birth to the American classic Turkey in the Straw. Ah, and then my mother stands and sings a ballad about an Irish country lad, Willie, who falls madly in love with the beautiful Annie. Wrenched from her arms by the cursed English army, Willie is sent off to fight in the Napoleonic Wars. After a long time passes, the dejected Annie, fearing her lover has been killed, falls ill from heartbreak and takes to her bed just as the young soldier fights his way back to Ireland, finally arriving at her door. My mother always takes a pause near the end of this ballad, letting the room filled with hushed suspense before she intones the fateful and final words of the song. "And he found she was dead." At this point, someone invariably takes a long drag on his cigarette, filling the room with smoke, and murmurs, "Ah, lovely, Mamie. Just lovely, God bless you." With the Irish, I came to realize, fairly early on, the sadder the better, especially when it came to love and patriotism. Blood and guts, martyrdom and death, the Irish could not get enough of it. As the saying goes, the great Gaels of Ireland are the men that God made mad, for all their wars are merry, and all their songs are sad. But in our home, we sang songs of every description. The aunts, the uncles, even the young cousins. My cousin Vincent Gallagher sings Galway Bay in his best Bing Crosby voice. And I sing, "Here's the same old shillelagh me father brought from Ireland." There are Irish songs of courtship, of motherly love, of the beauty of the land, of homesickness, as well as good old-fashioned Irish and American patriotic songs. And funny songs, too, like Eliza's Two Big Feet and Patty McGinty's Goat, famous for eating up all of Kate's folderols upon her wedding night. And on special occasions, my father even recites a favorite American poem, "The Face on the Barroom Floor." And then there was Patty O'Donnell, a next-door neighbor who we hardly spoke to from one end of the year to the next, but who never failed to show up after the Thanksgiving meal to sing. "Bless this house," he would sing, "Oh, Lord, we pray, make it safe by night and day. Bless these walls so firm and stout, keeping want and trouble out. Bless the hearth ablazing there, with smoke ascending like a prayer." I should add that no blazing hearth was ever found near our Bronx walk-up apartment. But Patty, despite his quavering and high-pitched voice, always manages to instill a silent reverence as the merriment of the evening slowly winds down. As Uncle Bernard takes his leave at the door, he crushes a dollar bill into my little hand and shushes me to silence, lest my parents insist I give the money back. The aunts, uncles, and cousins, with hugs and kisses, bid goodbye more than once before they go off into the end of the year cold night air until the next time. They're all long gone now, my Irish mother and father, and all my aunts and uncles. They were a brave generation of Irish men and women who were pilgrims in their own way, who came to America in the 1920s and 30s and are no more. On the edge of sadness, on this Thanksgiving Day, we remember them with a grateful heart.
Thank you.
Memoir is called Rolling Up the Rug. Mike Scanlon, author of the book Rolling Up the Rug, is my best friend. And in fact, I can speak for Mike and tell you that, you know, I'm his best friend as well. And, most of our mutual friends have flown the coop, but that's beside the point. Okay, so Mike and myself were sitting in the studio, and we're chatting, and hopefully, Anya Sheridan, if there was any flowery language in this, Anya, you took it out? Well, you didn't. Oh, jeez. All right, chat with Mike Scanlon.
And I have a friend of mine in the studio, indeed, friends for most of my life, and indeed for my time in America. One of the my great friends is Michael Scanlon, and Mike Scanlon and I are probably around 50 years.
It's hard to believe it.
Yeah. I think that many of our listeners, of course, would know you from various hats that you've worn in your life, that from being an actor to, to one day when you released a book, what was it, about 3-4 years ago?
Yes.
The book is called Rolling Up the Rug, and it is an Irish American New York story, and it captures, it gives us a great insight into growing up in High Bridge in the Bronx as an Arab.
That's right.
Tell us a bit, though, about your father and mother and from whence they came.
Well, you know, what inspired this book was, and you can understand this, Avery, because over the years I've enjoyed so much listening to you recount your growing up in County Mayo, and you know I have been enjoyed it, and you have this great gift of storytelling and lending color to all the events of your life, and I've had a bit of a interesting youth myself. And as we would talk, and I would talk about my mother and father and High Bridge, I realized I wanted to put something down about it and kind of like send a Valentine, you know, to my mother and father. And not only to them, but to all the other Irish people that I knew growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly people from the west of Ireland.
You know,
from Mayo, Sligo, Leitrim, Donegal, Clare, Galway, Kerry, Cork, of course.
Which we would refer to, you know, when we hear of rural Ireland, producer of the programs here, Anya Sheridan, who hails from Longford. But when we think of rural Ireland, somehow it's on the other side of the Shannon. You know, if you're in all of those counties that you've mentioned, to us that is rural Ireland. And if that's parochial, well, tough. That's the way it's...
That seemed to be most of the people that were that settled in that section of the Bronx. I seem to... I knew many, many people from Mayo and Galway and Clare and Cavan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you never meet anybody like from Leash, you know, or County, or
yeah.
Offaly, you would, yes.
Now, we want to ask you, though, about taking your father and mother. And as you point out, you know, that wave of immigrants who came out, you know, we somehow... have to fill that gap between, you know, the famine, the aftermath of the famine in Ireland, and then the next, big item of historic note, you know, is the Ireland's independence, the Free State, 1916. But there is a great story there about those who did leave Ireland around the turn of the century. And in your case, in your father's, in your mother's time, they barely missed the 1916 revolution in Ireland, which of course gave us the 26 counties.
Yeah.
I wonder if we could start by, you know, say, what was... As time went along, like did you have discussions with your father and mother, say, about the timing of of again the Easter Rising or anything, or did it have any effect at all?
Frankly, it never came up much. It didn't really come up much. I mean, I think that my father came over in 1928, which was 1 year before the Depression. He was 22 years old. And I think that it was just a matter of going off to seek what he thought would be a better life for himself.
Yeah.
And there was a huge wave of immigrants during the 1920s. I mean, mm-hmm. Ireland got its independence in 21, 22, I mean, essentially. And then, for some reason... there was this big wave that came over in the 20s.
Did they ever discuss why America? Because Ireland was kind of emptying out at the time. There were those who wound up in New Zealand and Australia, and of course England was a catch basin for... for a lot of Irish.
Well, in my mother's case... My mother was actually going to go to England. She was 16 years old, mm-hmm. and she was the oldest of five children, and they were thinking of sending her to England, but it turns out that she had two cousins mm-hmm. in New York who were nurses,
mm-hmm.
and the plan was to send my mother to New York and to get her into high school and to train to become a nurse like her two cousins. So that was that motivation. And in my father's case, he had known several people who had moved from Sligo, from his hometown.
Yeah.
And, the word gets back that they're doing well and making money. And so he got on the boat and came over in 1928. She came over in 1927.
Yes.
But mostly everybody I knew in Highbridge was a child of a parent who had come over in the 20s, and they were usually from the west of Ireland.
Let me ask you, Mike, about, say, your mother's case. How did she get sponsored here? Okay, so she had two cousins in New Jersey, who were nurses.
Right.
Money was very tight at that particular time, obviously.
Yes.
Ireland was in very bad shape.
Yes.
But was there, as we've come to pretty much accept later on, were there uncles and aunts who sent you the ticket? And
I think it must have been, but I don't know about that. I never heard about that. I think somehow they got the money together. I think they somehow did get the money together. But, you know, my mother's story is kind of like a story that's been told a lot. When I wrote this book, I thought my mother was kind of unique in leaving Ireland at 16.
Yeah.
Never to see her parents again. And when I calculated how old my grandmother was, my mother's mother, she was a woman in her mid-40s. You know, when I used to hear grandma, I always thought of this old woman.
Yes.
But this was a woman in her mid-40s saying goodbye to her 16-year-old girl. Mm. And never to see her again.
Yeah.
And I thought this was kind of unique.
Mm.
But it turns out the number of people that have come up to me and told me that that story is the story of their family as well. And then there's your own good self. Who came over yourself in 17.
Yeah.
Well, you managed to get back plenty of times, but you were only 17 too.
I was 17, and that was, I think the circumstances weren't that much different. I came in 59, from now 60 years ago, and the standard of living and people know, you know, now things have picked up quite a bit, and now you had radio and television was coming into Ireland at that time. However, Ireland was not ready to keep up with and to give gainful employment, you know, to these kids coming along,
yes.
You know. And it was almost the survival of the fittest, and every family, you know, had the black sheep. And so I came as a black lamb.
I never know it, Adrian. All the years we've spent together, God, I always thought you were the whitest sheep I've ever lived.
Well, I had the advantage, and I think most people had the advantage, of, you know, when I came here, of having relatives who
yes.
were actually
yes.
sponsors. They were not just, about to become saddled with the nephews and the relatives in Ireland. They actually had to put up their money or to become a sponsor.
Yes.
Before, of course, the drastic a change in the immigration policy in 1965, to get into the United States. All you needed was somebody to sponsor you to
yes.
take the financial obligation of making sure that you would not become a charge of the state. You
yes.
would not be... So we were lucky, and as you know, most people listening to the program and others would know, I had such an uncle in Paul O'Dwyer,
right.
who, and indeed I was at pretty much at the end of the string of relatives that he had sponsored here.
Yeah.
Took the whole family of the Burns from Kilkelly, Frank Durkin and his brother.
And was the former mayor of New York, Bill O'Dwyer, who was your uncle, was he around then too when you arrived?
He was, yes. He had now come back from Mexico. He was the U.S. ambassador to Mexico.
Yes.
But yeah, he had come around. But Paul was the caretaker of the family.
Yeah.
And so it, that's, as I say, how, you know, how we came, to be
right.
here. One of the things that we did have, which many would complain about much later on as immigrants, there was a built-in appreciation and respect for those who actually, you know, sponsored you.
Yes.
And you, that's,
you know, something that kind of stuck with you for a lifetime.
And indeed, you're making a good point as regards my family, because my father was the first in his family with nine children. He was the first to come to America. And his first mission was to get the money together to bring his brother over and his sister. And he brought his brother Patrick over, and then he brought his sister Amelia over. Mm-hmm. And my mother, the same way, a 16-year-old girl, mm-hmm. her first mission was to bring her brother John over and bring her sister Margaret over. And so you're right. That's how it started. How my mother got her money, I assume, was from the two cousins. I never heard how my father got his money to come over.
Yeah. Well, I think the understanding also was, and the custom, was that when you came to America and you got a job, the very first thing that you would be expected to do would be to send some money home, because the families were large. Now you have had the brothers and sisters, so even before that becomes the issue, you were...
You're right. Yeah.
And those, many of whom, you know, weren't making much money,
right,
they felt very, very gratified in sending money home, sending parcels from America.
Oh, I remember.
You know, parcels of clothing.
Remember my mother wrapping parcels when I was a little kid and sending it back. But my mother became a domestic to a doctor in Hackensack, New Jersey, and she told my daughter, when my daughter was writing a story about my mother.
Jennifer.
And my mother said she sent every penny. She was 16 years old. Every penny she made, she sent back. And she had the room and board free, you know?
Yes.
And it was just automatically assumed that that's the way it was, as you said.
Yeah. A great people and a great, we might as well segue into the book, because we're already painting a picture of the Irish immigrants coming here and getting together, and then whether Highbridge found them or they found Highbridge.
Yeah.
That was a click.
Yeah.
It really was at the end of the day, even though there were many other ethnics who were there. Highbridge at that particular age, you had a lot of Jewish people there?
Yes, it was half and half, really. It was half Irish and half Jewish, pretty much. There were German-Americans, there were Italian-Americans, but it was very strongly Irish and Jewish, And that's and everybody got along, and it was a special place. And since I've written this book, I've gotten so many people telling me how special our childhood was in this fabulous neighborhood that was supported by Sacred Heart Church. Of course, the church was the centerpiece, naturally.
Yeah.
The parish, of course, was always the center. You know, when you met somebody, you'd say, what parish are you from? You never said, what neighborhood did you live in?
Absolutely. And for that, to that end, so when we came here, we would, I would wonder, why a parish? Like, say, a neighborhood, get a clue, but again, it was the identity of the parish.
And the primacy of the church.
Yeah.
For the Irish.
Were there neighbors, I'm digressing here for a moment, were there neighbors who were less enthusiastic about the church and who may have either, had a reluctance to be, roped into what seemed to be better for the kids? Those who said, I don't know why I'm doing this,
Well, I mean, it was a very Catholic upbringing. It was like, you know, there was the Holy Name Society and the Ladies of Auxiliary and
the Ancient Order of Hibernians.
Ancient Order of Hibernians. My parents were members of Division 9 in the Bronx.
Yeah.
Very active, and it was a great social life for these people.
Yeah.
I mean, my mother and father had a fabulous social life. On St. Patrick's Day, they would go to the Mayo Ball, the Sligo Ball,
yeah.
And they clung together as Irish people, and it was a great life in terms of sociability.
Yeah, well, Russians knew, and indeed the tradition. Would continue for many decades after that is that people coming from Ireland might indeed come from the same county or a neighboring county or something else. They would meet in this
yes.
social, at dances and
yes.
at, places, you know.
It was birds of a feather flocking together.
Yeah.
And they made the best of it. My mother and father went out every single weekend to some event that was basically Irish.
Yeah.
And always with the music, you know.
Yeah.
And these people would come into my home, and they were the greatest people. I loved those Irish people, and they were always so generous to us as kids.
Yeah.
And they had a kind of a pride, you know, in us being Americans, too. They would watch us, and they wanted us to be Americans.
Yeah.
You know, we were kind of like a little bit of a bridge for them to America. And they always encouraged us in the American sports or American activities.
Yeah. Now, was Gaelic Park... Was that often...
That was a biggie for me,
yeah.
Of course, in the day.
Was it called Celtic?
No, it was called Croke Park.
Croke Park, yeah.
After the Croke Park in Dublin.
Yeah.
That's how far back I go.
Yeah.
And we used to go up there and sit on the splintery stands and, root for the various teams. And I would have preferred to be going to Yankee Stadium because I was a baseball player. But I used to love the Irish music after the games, of which, little did I know, you were going to become such an active part of that music.
Yeah, I there are those who could perhaps could rightfully accuse me of knowing absolutely nothing about sports, and I beg to differ because I spend more time.
That's right.
In Gaelic Park.
That's right.
And most people.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
now,
right.
I have to say I wasn't very attracted to whatever was going on out in the field.
Yeah.
But if you remember Gaelic Park.
Yeah.
It's a huge dance hall, a massive, long bar area.
Yeah.
And a field like you wouldn't, to us, it might as well have been.
Yeah.
You know, Yankee Stadium. And then, as musicians, we had this kind of a broom closet, you know, of a stage that you could have to, that you pack three or four musicians in.
Yeah.
Into that area. But the music and the dance.
The dancing, and of course the great inimitable Mickey Carton.
Absolutely.
Reading band with the accordion and the big smile.
Right.
Could light up a 11 o'clock mass.
I can remember with great distinction, you know, here I am, I came here at 17, so by 18, and for many years after that, I was a member of Mickey's band.
Yeah.
And we would be there, because theoretically we were playing from 2 to 6, which made the owner, John Kerry O'Donnell, one of the most brilliant people who ever come out of Kerry, because he wasn't that interested in the music, or the music that we were playing, but it was we were much better babysitters than anybody, you know, could be. Here's the fathers, you know, they're paying daddy, shake the kids up.
Yes.
And, you know, they get great credit from the mothers who were at home, and the father would show up with a couple of small little kids and take them directly into the dance hall and disappear.
Yeah, right, exactly, yes.
And you know, it was, and the kids, some of them, you know, 3 and 4, have, you know, the milk bottles and whatever. And, of course, we were there playing all kinds of music.
Right. Lots of American like a, this music, like along a, with the
yeah.
jigs and the reels.
But
yes.
It was like we were there for the creche, for the first,
yes.
You know, that this was a, it was funny. And what was, it would be only an odd day that we would be playing music in Gaelic Park, you know, that one, this was pre-Tamper era.
Yeah.
And you'd see this kid coming in, you'd know that safety pin is about ready to give.
That's right.
And you'd have this cloth diaper, you know, being kicked from one side of the place. But anyway, that's beside the point. I want to get to your book. And you pick up and weave with, not just because I say so, but if there's a book that could be said has a great flow to it, it is your book. And it's called Rolling Up the Rug.
Yes.
And you actually start your book by, you know, leading us all into, you know, what your scene was.
My father was a fiddler, an Irish fiddler.
Yeah.
And my mother was a pretty good singer, I must say. You know,
yeah.
She would be asked to sing the national anthem at little various events.
Yeah.
And they loved to have parties.
Mm.
And so I distinctly remember so vividly in the 1950s of a Saturday morning, my father and mother would clean out the furniture in the living room and make the whole room bare so that my mother could place these bridge chairs that she would actually rent for a night. And they would put the bridge chairs around the room and they would actually form a little tiny dance hall.
Mm-hmm.
And the ritual that always signaled that the most was when they got down on their knees and they started rolling up the big maroon rug, and there was the bare floor for the dancing. And they would take all of the couches and the tables and the rug, and they'd stuff them into the kids' bedroom or into their bedroom. And then the people would arrive at nighttime, and always they would be dressed to the nines, the men, you know, with perfectly starched shirts and big wide ties and clean shaven, and the women, you know, with really nice outfits,
yeah,
and all made up, you know, in the perfume and so on. And my mother would have gone out to buy food from the German delicatessen and buy cake from the Jewish bakery, and they'd send over a keg of beer. They'd actually have a keg in the house. And
Then
the music would start.
Right, but before we get to that and the music, was it the custom that guests who would come to the house might bring something, like maybe a soda bread?
They would, and the cakes particularly.
Yeah.
They'd bring the dessert, kind of like the desserts, because after the night was over with the dancing and the singing and the drinking, and then they would all, like, have, you know, some tea afterwards, you know.
Yeah.
And that would be where you'd bring the cakes and the pies, you know.
Yeah.
And people would walk in.
Now, your mother, Mamie, she was actually a Gallagher from
Leitrim.
From Leitrim.
Yeah.
What part of Leitrim?
Well, she actually lived right on the border between Leitrim and Donegal.
Yeah.
And her town, the one that I used to hear most about as a child, was Bundoor.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. Also you'd hear about Ballyshannon.
Yeah.
But they were very close to the town of Bundoor, which is actually in Donegal.
Yeah.
But my mother's house, apparently, part of the field was in Leitrim and the other part of the field was in Donegal. That's how close they were.
I don't want to miss out on an opportunity to, to step in here, as far back as I can remember when I came here and somebody would say, oh, where are your parents from? And say, oh, from Derry and Cork, to which, of course, the immediate knee-jerk reaction to that is, Jesus, how did you lose out twice? So, it was, again, that's an aside.
Well, that's an interesting thing that you want to explain to me about, you meet so many Americans who are like third and fourth and fifth generation, you ask them, like, well, where do you trace yourself back to? And more often than not, they'll say Cork.
Right.
And I remember you explaining to me that their ancestors left.
They left from Cove in County Cork.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, when I came here around that period of time, I thought that the only place that one could emigrate by ship was Cove. And, in fact, meeting people like yourselves and reading your book, there were many ports throughout Ireland, like
both of my parents left from Derry.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised to read. I found the manifest with my father's name on the ship. The California was the name of the ship, and I didn't realize that he never mentioned that he sailed from Derry. And my mother, of course, was closer to Derry, being in Donegal. They both sailed from Derry.
Yeah, it was a hell of a lot easier than schlepping all the way down to Cork and to Cove.
Yeah.
That was interesting that, we meet people and they sail from Galway, and even in song and everything.
Oh, really?
I was trying to figure out how did they... they leave from all of these different ports, but they don't. Michael, you bring us to the rolling up the rug, and now now the evening is coming. As kids, were you, what was the anticipation like? Did you know pretty much that this was going to be a special evening? Did you ever get dog sick of it, tired of it?
No, because I love the music. I love the Irish music, and I still do. I mean, I love traditional Cailey music. I just love it. And part of it is because it brings me back to my father. I mean, the first sounds in my house was my father playing the fiddle.
Yeah.
I once asked my father, Daddy, how did you learn how to play? How do you know what to play? Because, he never looked at music, written music. He said to me, well, I play by air, Mike. And I said, air? And I'm thinking he must have pulled the music out of the air. What he was actually saying was, I play by ear. And he could play anything. In fact, I remember so well when I went to Ireland with my father, and my uncle, my mother's brother, is an accordionist, and we were in Bundoran, and the pub had closed, and we went. The pub owner invited us back in the back room, and he closed it off, and the pints kept flowing in the back room, and my uncle Jim was playing the accordion, and my father was playing the fiddle. And my uncle Jim in Ireland was younger than my father and a little more hip on American tunes, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember them playing "That's Why the Lady is a Tramp."
Mm.
And here's my father, you know, my Irish father, you know, going along with it and picking it up because he could just pick it up from, you know, the way you're able to do on the piano.
Yeah.
I don't know how many people know that about you, that you can play anything under the sun if you just hum it to you.
Friends, my guest is Michael Scanlon. The book, by the way, is called Rolling Up the Rug, and it's a lovely story. It's something fascinating about the story that actually, whereas music can play a very central role, you know, in that atmosphere, in that neighborhood. Mike, what's the best way to get this book?
Amazon. It's as simple as that, you know.
Amazon.
Rolling Up the Rug, an American-Irish story, Michael Scanlon, and you can get it on Amazon.